7. And meanwhile, the superb handwrought speech, untouched, remained in Joseph Adams's briefcase. Lindblom remained, shakily lighting a cigarette and trying not to involve himself, for the moment, in further conversation. He had had enough. He remained because he was too exhausted to go. "You have it in your power," Adams said as he seated himself at his desk, opened his briefcase, and got out his speech, "to get me picked off."
"I know,"
Lindblom muttered. Walking toward the door, Adams said, "I'm going to vac this. Get it to the sim and on tape, and then the hell with it. Then, what do we call the new project? This forging of non-Terran artifacts to put a man in prison whose whole life is devoted to seeing that decent housing is..."
"The Nazis," Lindblom interrupted,
"had no written orders regarding the final solution. The genocide of the Jews. It was done orally. Told by superior to subordinate. Handed down by word of mouth, if you don't object to an absurd mixed metaphor. You probably do." "Let's go have a cup of coffee," Adams said. Lindblom shrugged. "What the hell? They've decided it's runcible. Who are we to say it isn't? Show me. Conjure up someone else who would benefit by tipping off tanks."
"I'd be glad to," Adams said, and saw Lindblom look disconcerted.
"Any one of the thousands of tankers living in Runcible's Conaps, all it would take would be one who got away, wasn't picked up by Broz's agents or footmen, made his way back to his own ant tank, then from it contacted a neighboring tank, and then from that tank to..."
"Yeah," Lindblom agreed stolidly.
"Sure.
Why not? Except, would his fellow tankers let him back into his tank? Wouldn't they think he was hot or had... what name did we make up to call it? The Bag Plague. They'd massacre him on sight, because they believe the reading matter we give them on TV every damn day of the week and twice on Saturday night just in case. They'd think he was a living missile. And anyhow, there's more you don't know. You ought to hand over a few bucks to the Foot Organization now and then, pick up a little inside news. These tankers that have been tipped off about conditions up here, they weren't tipped off by anybody they knew. It wasn't one of their own members coming back."
"Okay, the tanker couldn't reach his own tank, so instead..."
"They got it," Lindblom said, "over the coax."
For a moment, Adams failed to understand. He stared at Lindblom.
"That's right," Lindblom said. "On their TV set. For about 1 minute, and very feeble, but enough."
"Good God," Adams said, and he thought, "there are millions of them down there. What would it be like if someone cut into the main coax, the chief, sole and central trunk from Estes Park that reached all the tanks? What would it be like to have the earth open and millions of humans imprisoned subsurface for 15 years, believing in a radioactive waste above with missiles and bacteria and rubble and warring armies? The domain system would sustain a death blow, and the great park over which he flappled twice daily would become a densely populated civilization once more, not quite as before the war, but close enough. Roads would reappear. Cities. And... ultimately, there would be another war." That was the rationale. The masses had egged their leaders on to war in both West Dem and Pak Piop, but once the masses were out of the way, stuffed down below into antiseptic tanks, the ruling elite of both East and West were free to conclude a deal, although, strangely, in a sense, it had not been them at all. Not Broz, not General Holt, who had been CNC of West Dem, or even Marshal Heronzany, the top officer in the hierarchy of Soviet brass. But the fact that both Holt and Heronzany knew when it was time to use the missiles, and had done so, and when time had come to quit, this was all true, and without it, without their joint reasonability, peace would not have been possible. But underneath this collaboration of the two top military men lay something else. Something which, to Adams, was real and strange, and in a sense, deeply moving. The Recon Dissing Council of Leadys in Mexico City, Amacamaca. It had assisted in the job of forcing peace on the planet. And, as a governing body, a final arbiter, it had not gone away. Man has built a weapon that could think for itself, and after it had thought a while,
2 years in which vile destruction had occurred, with the Lettys locked hip and thigh each with the other, two huge artificial armies from two landmasses, advanced varieties of Lettys who had been constructed with the eye toward utilizing their analytical brains for planning tactics and finally overall strategy. These advanced types, the 10, 11, and 12 varieties, had figured out that the best strategy was something which the Phoenicians had learned 5,000 years ago. It was summed up, Adams reflected, in the Mikado. If merely saying that a man had been executed was enough to satisfy everyone, why not merely say it instead of doing it? The problem was really, to the advanced Lettys, that simple. They were not Gilbert and Sullivan buffs, and Gilbert's words were not in their artificial brains. The text of the Mikado had not been programmed into them as operational data, but they had arrived at the same conclusion, and had in addition acted on it, in conjunction with Marshal Haron Zany and CNC General Holt. Aloud, Adams said, "But they didn't see the advantage." "Pardon?" Lindblom murmured, still shaky, still unwilling to engage in any more talk. He looked tired. "What the Recon Disin Council didn't see," Adams said, "and can't see now because there's no libido component to their perceptmentation systems, is that the maxim, why execute someone—" "Oh, shut up," Lindblom said, and turning, stalked out of Joseph Adams' office, leaving him standing there alone, speech in hand, idea in mind, doubly frustrated. But he could hardly blame Lindblom for being upset, because all the Yance men had this streak. They were selfish. They had made the world into their deer park at the expense of the millions of tankers below. It was wrong, and they knew it, and they felt guilt. Not quite enough guilt to cause them to knock off bros and let the tankers up, but enough guilt to make their late evenings a thrashing agony of loneliness, emptiness, and their nights impossible. And they knew that if anyone could be said to be amending the crime committed, the theft of an entire planet from its rightful owners, it was Louis Runcible. They gained by keeping the tankers down, and he gained by luring them up. The Yance Man elite confronted Runcible as an antagonist, but one whom they knew, deep down inside, was morally in the right. It was not a sanguine feeling, at least not to Joe Adams, as he stood alone in his office, gripping his superb speech, which was to be vacked, run through the sim, taped, then castrated from Brose's office. This speech, it did not tell the truth, but it was not a pastiche of cliches, lies, bromides, euphemisms, and more sinister ingredients, which Adams had noticed in speeches dreamed up by his fellow Yance men. After all, he was only one speechwriter from among a pack. Carrying his highly prized new speech, so regarded by him, anyhow, in the absence of a contrary consensual validation, he left his office and, by express elevator, dropped to the floor where Megavac 6V chugged away. Floors, rather, in that the total works of the organism had undergone accretive changes over the years, refinements that had added to it whole new parts occupying entire new layers. Megavac 6V was huge, but in contrast, the sim itself remained the same as always. Two uniformed toughs, bros hand-picked but oddly effete, physiognomically dainty roughnecks, eyed him as he emerged from the elevator. They knew him. They understood that his presence on Megavac 6V's programming floor was mandatory in view of his job. He approached the keyboard of Megavac 6V, saw that it was in use. Another Yance man, unfamiliar to him, was whacking away at the keys like a virtuoso pianist at the end of a Franz Liszt opus, with double octaves and all, everything but hammering with the fist. Above the Yance man, his written copy was suspended, and Adams gave in to the impulse. He moved close to inspect it. At once, the Yance man ceased typing. "Sorry," Adams said. "Let's see your authorization." The Yance man, quite dark, youthful and small, with almost Mexican-like hair, held out his hand peremptorily. Sighing, Adams got out of his briefcase the memo from Geneva, from Brose's bureau, entitling him to vac this particular speech. The document had a stamped code number, entered on the memo as well. The dark, small Yance man compared the document with the memo, seemed satisfied, returned both to Adams.
"I'll be through in 40 minutes." The youth resumed typing. "So bounce off and leave me alone."
His tone was neutral but forbidding. Adams said, "I rather like your style." He had quickly, briefly scanned the page of script on top. It was good stuff, unusually so. Again, the Yance man ceased typing.
"You're Adams."
Once more, he extended his hand, this time for shaking purposes. They shook, then, and the strained atmosphere reduced to a tolerable level. But there was always the I'm-bigger-than-you competitiveness in the air when two Yance men met, either away from the agency at their domains or here, right on the job. It always made the day just that much tougher to get through, and yet Adams thrived on it. If not, he realized, he would long since have gone under.
"You've done some good pieces. I've watched the final tapes."
Studying him with his sharp, bright, black, deeply set Mexican-type eyes, the young Yance man said,
"But a lot of your work has been axed at Geneva, or so I hear."
"Well," Adams said stoically, "it's either axed or it's coaxed in this business. There's no such thing as half-transmitting."
"You want to bet?"
The youth's tone was brittle, penetrating. It disconcerted Adams. Guardedly, because, after all, both of them, in essence, were competing for the same prize, Adams said, "I suppose a jejune watered-down speech could be considered..."
"Let me show you something."
The dark, young Yance man rose. Yank shut the master circuit breaker so that the vac began processing what he had fed it up to now. Together, Adams and the dark young Yance man walked over to view the sim. There it sat, solely at its large oak desk with the American flag behind it. In Moscow, another and identical sim sat with a duplicate of Megavac 6V, the flag of the USSR behind it. Otherwise, everything, the clothes, the gray hair, the competent, fatherly, mature, but soldierly features, the strong chin, it was the same sim all over again, both having been built simultaneously in Germany, wired by the finest Yance man technicians alive. And here, maintenance men perpetually skulked, watching with trained, narrow eyes for any sign of failure, even a fraction of a second hesitation, anything which might mitigate the quality striven for, that of free and easy authenticity. This simulacrum, out of all which they, the Yance men, were involved in, required the greatest semblance of the actuality which it mimicked. A breakdown here, Adams realized soberly, however minute, would be catastrophic. Like the time its left hand in reaching out. A huge red warning light on the wall lit. A buzzer buzzed. A dozen main men for the simulacrum materialized to scrutinize. Catastrophic. As the time the reaching left hand went into a spasm of pseudo-Parkinsonism, a neural motor tremor, indicating, had the tapes been put on the cable, the insidious start of senility. Yes, that would have been the tanker's interpretation, most probably. "He's getting old," they would have muttered to each other as they sat in their communal halls, overseen by their polecoms. "Look, he's shaky. The strain. Remember Roosevelt. The strain of the war got to him, finally. It'll get the protector. And then what'll we do?" But it hadn't been put on the coaxial cable, of course. The tankers had never seen that sequence. The sim had been opened up, thoroughly gone over, tested and checked and certified. A miniaturized component had been spat on, denounced as the malefactor, and, at a workbench in one of the shops of Runcible's Conaps, a workman had been quietly relieved of his duties, and possibly his life, without ever knowing why or what, because in the first place, he hadn't known what the tiny output coil or diode or just plain thing had been used for. The sim began to move, and Joseph Adams shut his eyes, standing as he was, out of range of the cameras, hidden with this small, dark, very young but expert Yance man, the author of the words about to be uttered. "Maybe it'll go out of its mind," Adams thought wildly, "and begin to recite pornographic ballads, or, like one of those antique disc records of the previous century, repeat a word, repeat a word, repeat a word." "My fellow Americans," the sim said in its firm, familiar, near-hoarse but utterly controlled voice. To himself, Joseph Adams said, "Yes, Mr. Yancey. Yes, sir."